Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 135, Fair Isle Knitting, Sunday, September 11th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. There's great conversation about each episode and other pertinent topics on the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry, and I put up a blog post with photographs, links, and other information for every episode on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. This episode is being recorded on Sunday, September 4th, because next weekend, the weekend of the 10th and 11th, there is a very popular jazz festival here in Delaware Water Gap. And the studio where I record on Sunday mornings will not be its usual tranquil space. I also plan to be having a lot of fun at the jazz festival, so I want to take a week off of recording but still have an episode coming out. In fact, there's really too many fun things going on in one weekend. The weekend of the jazz festival is also the weekend of my class, my Sheep to Shawl class at Fibercraft Studio, and the entire weekend is the weekend of the New Jersey Sheep and Wool Festival. So I will not be able to participate in all three of those things. I'm thinking about two of them, and I think the weather will be the determining factor. Today's episode is a bit about Fair Isle Knitting, and I will have some of my regular segments, including the front porch, ever-expanding skill set, and off the shelf. I hope you enjoy the episode. Since there are some non-knitters and beginning knitters listening to the Yarns at Yin Hu podcast, I thought I'd begin with just a brief overview of Fair Isle Knitting. The term is related to Fair Isle, which is one of the Shetland Islands, and has some traditional roots. It's also used in a broad manner to refer to knitting with various different colors. The most traditional kinds of Fair Isle knitting involve about 4 to 5 different colors, but the knitter is only using 2 colors at any one time, and the pattern motifs are quite small so that the switching of one color and another happens quite frequently. That makes for relatively easier knitting because when the shifts in color change happen over a long period of time, there are these things called floats. And if you've ever had a sweater that contains Fair Isle knitting and you turn it inside out, you can see a little bit of the architecture of what's going on with the knitting behind the scenes. In general, you want only a few stitches worth of yarn carried behind the work at one time, because if it's a long piece, that's really easy to catch on something when you're putting the sweater on or taking it off. In terms of the look of the work on the front, long floats behind the knitting can mean that there are tension differences and pulling and bunching. And so you need to do this maneuver where you hook the yarn behind the knitting every so often so that you don't get those long floats. So traditional Fair Isle motifs with those very small patterns make it so that you don't have to worry about long floats. Also, more muted and relatively traditional colors are often used in ferrule knitting, but nowadays knitters can choose a wide variety of very flamboyant colors in their knitting. It's nice to have a contrast between colors so that the pattern motifs really stand out. And one thing that I've learned about ferrule knitting is colors that might seem to be contrasting aren't necessarily contrasting when you start putting them together in your knitting. And sometimes something that might seem to be more vibrant is actually a little bit more muted when you start knitting. One thing that seems pretty consistent with ferrule knitting is that often the overall impact, especially to a non-knitter, makes the piece appear more difficult than it really is. And I have not done too much ferrule knitting. I just went through my projects on Ravelry and I developed a tag and put them together. Probably my most complex ferrule knitting so far was an Advent scarf that was knit in a tube. And this was designed by Trisha at my local yarn shop, who designs an Advent scarf each year. It was three colors, and each day of the Advent season, there was a different motif to knit. And then there were a few rows in between, and then the next pattern. I knit the scarf over the course of the Advent season for my mom, and I was not able to keep up with every single day of the knitting. There were some really large motifs on a few of the days. And so what I ended up doing was I knit most of the motifs, but then I repeated a few that I really liked. And then I Kitchenered the ends of the scarf together to make this big loop. So it can be worn as a long cowl, or it can be doubled over the neck for something really warm and dense. Ferrule knitting tends to be pretty warm because in the places where there is patterning, there are actually two layers of yarn in those places instead of one. Sometimes a garment with ferrule will have patterning in just a few sections of the garment, specifically the yoke, maybe near the cuffs of the sleeves and near the hem. And then a big portion of the garment will just be knit in one main color in stockinette stitch. The yarn for ferrule knitting needs to be 100% wool yarn. And often it's a fingering or a sport weight yarn that's 2-ply and dyed in a variety of colors, although a range of natural colors is also a beautiful choice for ferrule knitting. I suppose there are some exceptions to the 100% wool, but I can't see myself ever choosing anything other than that because the beauty of ferrule knitting relies on the qualities of wool. Once you soak and block that piece, the stitches sit together in such a way that the beauty of the motif really shines through. For me, the challenge of ferrule knitting is, number one, color selection, and number two, the challenge of holding two strands of yarn for knitting rather than just one. The customary wisdom for knitting ferrule is that the yarn that's held further to the left in the knitter's hand will be the color that emerges in the pattern. So often, knitters who knit ferrule will hold the contrasting color in their left hand and the main color in their right hand. And the yarn in that left hand will be knit just a little bit more loosely so that that pattern can emerge in the knitting. And there are some really interesting photographs of the same pattern in the same colors, but the knitter was holding the yarn in opposite hands. And in one case, the pattern motif actually recedes into the knitting. And in the other example, it's much more beautiful and more apparent. I suppose there are some contradictions to this depending on the tension and the grip of the knitter and how an individual knitter manipulates the yarn. But for me, that rule holds true that I hold the contrasting color in my left hand and a main color or the color that I don't necessarily want to emerge as much in my right hand. Since I knit continental, I'm used to holding yarn in my left hand. And so it's working with my right hand that is a little more challenging for me because I'm not an English style knitter or a thrower. The front porch. This topic of Fair Isle knitting has come up for me because I have decided to knit the Bressa dress designed by Gudrun Johnston for Rhinebeck for this year. So I just began this knitting at the end of August and my deadline is mid-October. And so far I have knit the yoke of this dress and divided for the sleeves and the body. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about how the project is going so far. I have learned that the pronunciation of this pattern is Bressa, even though it's spelled B-R-E-S-S-A-Y. And it refers to one of the Shetland Islands, one of the inhabited Shetland Islands, with a population of about 360 people. And the island is about 11 square miles. It doesn't seem to me from my research that the design refers to anything specific on the island, but maybe there is some kind of reference in the motif that I haven't picked up on. Bressa can be translated broad island, and there are two rather interesting features to this island. There aren't too many roads, but there is ferry service. It's a popular destination for tourists because of the migrant birds on the island. And there's also this feature of the Bressa stone, which is Pictish. It was discovered in 1852, and Pictish refers to a group of tribes living in eastern and northern Scotland in the late Iron Age. And there's a stone. The stone that's there on the island today is actually a replica, and the actual stone is in a museum in Edinburgh. But the stone is reportedly a memorial for the daughter of a chieftain, and it's this beautiful stone that, I'm not sure how tall it is, but it seems like maybe it's 4 or 5 feet tall, and it has carved images on the stone. The exact meaning seems to be in some dispute, but it's clear that this is example of really interesting and ornate stone carving, and something that seems like a real pleasure to see. So that was interesting to learn a little bit about Bressa, the island, in connection with this dress. The dress appears in a book of patterns called Fair Isle Style and was coordinated by Mary Jane Mucklestone. There are various different designers featured in the book. And since I purchased the book, I guess over a year ago, I've really had my eye on this Bressa dress. It's a short sleeve tunic length dress with a colorwork yoke, a little bit more colorwork at the hemline, and some beautiful patch pockets in a semicircular design that are attached to the work after it's completed. It's just really, really cute, and I thought it would be a good candidate for using up some of the sport weight 100% wool yarn in my stash. Some of this yarn, I know the origin and I know the brand. There's a Bartlett yarn cone. There's also some Ella Ray sport yarn. And then there's quite a bit of unknown yarn. I'm using black to knit this dress because I have a lot of it and because I think that the beautiful Fair Isle motif will emerge very nicely on a black background. Gudrun Johnson's pattern has three contrasting colors, but I have chosen four. I've chosen a beautiful mountain laurel purple, an aqua, an ivory, and kind of a camel color. I thought that this color would be like a pumpkin color, a little bit more orange. But like I said earlier, when colors are knit into Fair Isle, sometimes their effect is more muted than it seems like it's going to be when you just look at the yarn in balls and skeins before you start knitting with it. So the overall effect of the patterning is a little bit muted, but I think still really beautiful. And since I'm using the four colors, I'm also mirroring my use of color in this design so that there's a little bit of patterning and I guess the coloration works symmetrically more or less. I'll include a few photographs of my work so far so that you can get an idea of what I mean. This pattern design is meant to be knit on fingering weight yarn on US size 4 needles. But as I mentioned, I'm using sport weight yarn because that is what I have in my yarn stash. I'm also a relatively loose knitter, and even more so when I use a Fair Isle technique or stranded knitting technique, I tend to knit loosely because I'm worried about the pattern motifs bunching up or looking too tight. One thing that completely destroys the beauty of Fair Isle knitting is to knit too tightly. That will not block out, that will not relax enough for you to really be able to see the patterning if you knit too tightly. So I'm a loose knitter and I tend to be even more of a loose knitter when knitting Fair Isle. So in order to align the sizing of the dress with the yarn and the needle that I'm using, I've decided to knit this dress in sport weight yarn on US size 3 needles, and I'm following the smallest pattern directions for a 32.5-inch bust. I'm hoping that this results in a dress suitable for a 36-inch bust. And once the yoke is complete, it's really just knitting stockinette in the round in black. So if I need to do fewer increases or more increases, I can adjust the pattern as I go. Since this is a top-down construction, I'm also able to try the dress on as I knit and then make adjustments accordingly. I began this knitting with a tubular cast on because there's a bit of a ribbed neckline and I wanted that to be nice and finished and polished. So I did a tubular cast on and then I knit the neckline in 2x2 ribbing. Before the color work begins, there's also a little bit of short row shaping so that the back of the neck is a little bit longer than the front, and this results in a very flattering fit. So far, I have knit the entire color work yoke, and I have divided the neck and the sleeves, and I'm now just knitting stockinette in the round for the body of the dress. I noticed in the photographs of this dress and also in Ravelry project pages that there's a little bit of flare on the sleeve, which I don't care for at all. I'm pretty sure that the flare is the result of increases in the sleeve, and I just plan not to do any. I've also seen that some folks have extended the length of their sleeves, and that might be an idea if I have enough yarn. So far, I really like the way this dress is coming out. I feel like it is a somewhat ambitious goal to complete this in just over a month's time, but I am very motivated to do it. And I hope that if I complete the project and wear it to Rhinebeck, that the weather is cooperative for a garment like this. now that I feel like I'm having some success with this ferrule project, I just see new ferrule patterns wherever I look. I've been skimming through Fair Isle Style, and for a while there have been quite a few patterns that I'm attracted to, but now I just can't wait to knit the mushroom Killy Muffs, which are an adorable pair of fingerless mitts with a mushroom design. And then I'm also dreaming about knitting the Miri Dancers Pullover. This is the beautiful project featured on the cover of the book and is inspired by the color play of the Northern Lights. It's pretty ambitious in terms of its use of color. It employs a more modern approach with lots of rich jewel tones. And I think there are over 10 colors in the pattern. So that would be an ambitious project, but maybe something that I can tackle in the future if I have success with the project I'm working on now. And then the most recent issue of Taproot Magazine, issue 19, the Wander issue, arrived in my mailbox. And in the hands section, which is always devoted to projects and things you can make, is the story of this journal cowl. It's a pattern by Beatrice Perrone Dahlin. She knit it based on a trip that she took, an epic journey with her husband many years ago. And it's not so much an exact pattern as kind of a recipe for knitting your own journal cowl. So this, like the cowl I've knit previously, is knit in the round, and you can sew it into one long tube that can hang down or maybe be doubled or I suppose even tripled if you're very ambitious around your neck for extra warmth. You can choose different colors, and then she gives the instructions for many different motifs based on travel. She also says that she chose a cast on of 96 stitches because it's divisible by so many numbers and really invites creativity with pattern design and color play. And I just can't stop thinking about this cowl. I think it's the perfect combination of knitting and writing. It's almost like you're writing your thoughts or the idea of a journey, maybe a trip you're planning, a trip you took, or even some other kind of a journey. You're writing or knitting it into your cowl. So I have this project in my sights, and I think that what I would like to do is start gathering some colors. I would like to knit this in fingering weight yarn. I have some in stash, but I may acquire some additional and begin this pattern at the beginning of the new year. Maybe you would like to join me. If you're a subscriber to Taproot and you have some interest, I hope you will let me know, because maybe this is a project we could take on together and we could journal and knit and have something really beautiful and fabulous and really personalized at the end of that journey. Once again, I will repeat the patterns that I mentioned in this section, and I will link to them in the show notes on my website. I'm knitting the Bressa dress designed by Gudrun Johnson. I also mentioned the Mushroom Killy Muffs and Miri Dancers Pullover. All three of these are featured in Fair Isle Style by Mary Jane Mucklestone. And then I also mentioned the Journey Cowl designed by Beatrice Perrone Dahlin. It appears in issue 19 of Taproot Magazine. Ever-expanding skill set. The featured ingredient for hashtag Power Pantry for the month of September is mushrooms. I think with knitting these magic corkshrooms, playing the game Morels, and dreaming about knitting these mushroom Killy Muffs, it seemed very logical that mushrooms would be the featured ingredient for September. And I think it's a really accessible ingredient and something that folks who are cooking vegan and vegetarian use quite a bit. So mushrooms, whether they're foraged, cultivated, dried, there are even different kinds of mushroom pastes and mixtures available. All of these are potential candidates for cooking along with hashtag Power Pantry during the month of September. There is a mushroom vendor at the local farmers market here in Monroe County, Pennsylvania. And I don't know why, but I just felt kind of intimidated about buying mushrooms because I know they can be expensive and I know there are very good reasons for that, but I didn't want to arrive at the booth and just be taken by surprise at the price of something. I don't know why. I just felt very intimidated. But this Saturday, I went to the booth and found that this vendor, who is woodsfresh.com online, is the most delightful, engaging, informative person. And we made a transaction. I bought 4 ounces of incredible shiitake mushrooms to cook with at home. And he even gives cooking advice and tips. And I believe he is very popular super early in the morning for some foraged mushrooms that he brings in limited quantities. But I'll definitely be getting his booth a visit again in the future. And I had just a fabulous experience cooking these shiitake mushrooms. So I removed the stems because the stems of some mushrooms can be quite woody, but I reserved them in a special bag that I have in my freezer. And this recent lot of shiitake mushroom stems was just enough to fill the bag. So before the end of the month, I will be using all of those stems and trimmings to make a mushroom stock. I've been wanting to do this for quite a while, but I wanted to accumulate enough material that the stock is really rich tasting. So I was able to fill up my freezer bag with enough stems for a stock, and then I just sauteed those sliced shiitake mushrooms very, very slowly in butter over medium heat so it wouldn't be too high. And then I added some dark leafy greens and served them over some lotus noodles. These are black noodles with like a really sort of woodsy taste to them. And a little bit of a sauce made from miso paste to kind of maximize that umami flavor. This was absolutely delicious and it just felt filling but not heavy, and the taste of those sauteed shiitake mushrooms really came through. So I know that I'm going to have a great time cooking with mushrooms this September, and I hope you will join along for hashtag Power Pantry. You can use that hashtag to post photographs and comments on social media, and there's also a thread opened on Ravelry for discussion and recipe sharing. One thing I've always thought about doing, but I've never taken the plunge, is to take some type of a course or sign up for a walk where you can learn a little bit more about foraging for mushrooms. It can be very dangerous to forage if you don't know what you're doing or what you're looking for, and I really would like the opportunity to learn from an expert, but I haven't taken the plunge to do it. If you have any experience in doing this or in taking a course, I would love to hear about it and to learn about your thoughts on the topic because it's something I think it's in my future, I think. For Off the Shelf, I've selected a poem on the topic. It's called Morel Mushrooms, written by Jane Whitledge. Softly they come, thumbing up from the firm ground, protruding unharmed, easily crumbled, and yet how they shouldered the leaf and mold aside, rising unperturbed, breathing obscurely, still as stone. By the slumping log, by the dappled aspen, they grow alone. A dumb eloquence seems their trade. Like hooded monks in a sacred wood, they say, tomorrow we are gone.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves are down like a lady waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Kurtz sings, but out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for joining me. Music for this episode is Sweet. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Nature's ever get you high till your face is mine. Jump on a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a Sweet nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.